Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now there's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book I do the review and put up here on the podcast feed, or like today I don't finish the book and then do the review and then put the review up here on the podcast feed. We'll see how it goes. Anyway, so thanks a lot for everyone's feedback over the last week or so. I hope everyone's had a pleasant new year and Christmas or holiday season or anything like that. I do quite enjoy the little fad of putting "I'm a genius" in emails, which you'll understand probably from the last episode or the episodes before that, whatever it is. Anyway, keep sending in the emails, luke@juggler.net. I've had some really great email discussions with different listeners. If you want to have, like you say, because I reply to every single email that I get, and if you want to have some sort of more general feedback, just a quick comment or something, the best way to do that is to go onto goodreads.com/Luke Burridge and find me there and follow me there, and you can send me messages that way as well. Either that, you know, email goodreads.com, that's the best way to get in contact with me. So I'm not going to talk very much about news really, because I don't feel like it. Broke up with my girlfriend, etc. Have a really bad ear. My entire left hand side of my head is completely blocked up and I can only half hear myself talk, so hopefully I'm not going to talk too loud or too soft. The good thing is that normally in conversations over the last few days, because I've had this blocked ear, I can't tell if I'm talking and I miss lots of stuff, but now I've actually got a graphical representation of how loud I'm talking by Audacity open in front of me, and I'm watching the recording here. So anyway, yeah, book today. I finished two books. Well, I didn't finish this one. I finished another book, Starship Troopers by Heinlein, and I thought I would review that one first, but I realised that because I have this other book so much on my mind, and they are the complete opposites in pretty much every single way, I decided to put off reviewing that and use that sort of review maybe as a counterpoint to this review. I'm going to be reviewing now Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, Let me just say a little bit about it. It was 1957. It's a fucking huge book. Like, how many pages is it? Quickly pop to the end of this book here. It's 1,168 pages long. And they're not small pages, they're big pages with a lot of writing on them and stuff like that. So here we go. I read this book mainly because it was in the library on the cruise ship I'm on at the moment, and I'm on the cruise ship for 20 days or so, and I thought, yeah, maybe in 20 days I'll be able to get through Atlas Shrugged. And also, it's because I was running low on audiobooks, otherwise it was going to be this, or, like I say, Starship Troopers, or another Alistair Reynolds book. And I've read all the other science fiction books in the library, especially the ones in the... And this was the last one in the classic science fiction works part of the classics of, in the library as well. You know, because I think I've read other books from this library and reviewed them over the last few years. Things like... not 1984. Was it Brave New World and other books like that I've reviewed here too. So I thought, well, I'll give it a go. It's meant to be science fiction. It's filed as science fiction, so there it is. However, I didn't finish the book, and I've no intention of finishing the book. Now, sometimes I've reviewed books that I didn't finish, mainly because I read enough of them to know that I didn't want to go on and that they were just shit books, like badly written books. Like, you know, like the Dune prequels and midquels and The Fall of Hyperion and also Contact, which lots of people, Contact, and other books, you know. And so generally they get a low rating because I just don't finish them because I don't think they're worth finishing. And I do the review either. Anyway, and there's other books that I start and work out quite quickly that the book just isn't for me. For example, like the Doomsday book by Connie Willis, I started that and realised, actually, this is probably not a book that I'm going to enjoy, but I didn't do a review of it because I only got a few chapters in. Also, Post Singularity, there's another book that I started by Rudy Rucker, and it was like the worst opening chapters of like any book that I've read, and so I just stopped straight away. And there's no point in me reviewing that because I didn't get enough into it to actually do something, you know, to review it. However, there is another book that I started and didn't finish, but I think I read enough of it to sort of understand why it wasn't a book for me, and that was Last and First Men. And I started reading it, thought it was going to be a novel, turned out it wasn't really a novel, it was more of a textbook, like a fictionalized history textbook kind of thing, and I didn't feel bad in not finishing it, but I didn't give it a rating, so I think that's what I'm going to do the same now. This is going to be a review very much more like Last and First Men, where I talk about the ideas of the book, but I can't rate it because I only got half of the way through it. Well, actually what I did is that I read the first, just under half of the book, and then I decided to skip forward, sort of sampling bits here and there, and then to make sure I didn't sort of miss any major events I checked Wikipedia and a few other quick reviews just to make sure that I didn't miss the stuff. And I, like I say, I'm not apologising, and I don't want this to be a normal review of a book, and I'm not going to give it a rating because I didn't finish it, but because I realised it wasn't really a novel. It wasn't really a book for me. So anyway, let's just get straight into it. The world of this book, it's set in, I guess, 1950s America, but like an alternative 1950s America where the USA is sliding into a communist-style kind of collectivist regime, state in some way. And it seems like this has already happened around the rest of the world. So I'm thinking it's sort of like an alternative 1950s world where the Second World War hasn't happened and it hasn't sort of kickstarted the economies in all these different countries and things like that. The world is declining into sort of lots of communist states or other kind of states with other kind of regimes. And America is sort of trying to hold out as the last bastion of sort of free market capitalism. Everywhere else is called like the People's Republic of this, or the People's State of England, or the People's State of Australia, whatever it is. But, you know, America is just America. So, but it's slowly, like I say, sliding into that kind of communist collectivist state regime. And this is being portrayed as a dystopic kind of thing, you know, rightly so, I guess, the way it's been described in the book anyway. And the government is grabbing for more and more power, but they don't grab it like, they don't take away the freedoms of the people so much as take away the freedoms of the industrialists in the name of fairness. And, you know, the government is crippling the businesses in ability to do their jobs. So that's pretty much the setup of this book and the people who, in their own way, fight back against this. It's not really, a book like, say, 1984, which I reviewed a while ago, where it's sort of like a personal struggle. It's definitely sort of like a big political struggle. So a lot of the action takes place in offices and apartments and in hotels in New York, although it does at the beginning of the book, but also in lots of factories and foundries and railways across America. And everything we see during the novel seems to get more and more decayed. It's sort of everything's collapsing slowly, and as you see that throughout the book. Now, the thing is with this world is that there's two parts that I want to bring up about the world. One is that the infrastructure of the world is very, very well described. The places and the objects, you know, the broken down factories, they're the most lifelike things in this book, because as a writer, Ayn Rand, actually, she's really good at evocative imagery of the physical world. So a lot of it, you know, you're sort of there, you really feel like you're in the place, you're sort of experiencing the things that the characters are seeing around them. But on the other hand, the entire world is completely preposterous. Now, I'm saying this straight off the bat, not because I think a preposterous world is a bad thing. For example, if the book was like a pure allegory, or, you know, like I wouldn't mind it, like a fairy tale, you know, when they say a long time ago in a land far, far away, there was castles and knights and all that kind of stuff. We never actually have to examine the economics or the, you know, the political system or the societies or anything like that, because that's not what the book is about. It's about the characters, about people growing up. It's about death. It's about, you know, losing your virginity and all these different things that fairy tales are talking about. You know, they're talking about life experiences set up in a preposterous world. Great. Or you can have like a science fiction book like Brave New World, which I made a note here as well. There's world is built from the ground up to be preposterous, but the people who live in the world, they know it's preposterous in a way, but then they don't know it's preposterous because they're constantly drugged and they've been selected from birth and indoctrinated from birth. In fact, I think even from before birth, they're selected in test tubes and stuff like that into their caste and life, and that's how they live it. Or the other way to look at a preposterous world is like the real world, where, you know, I see stuff going on around the world and I think the world is quite preposterous. But by examining it more closely, I can sort of see how the preposterous world I live in came to be. And, you know, whether by sort of political planning or by, you know, accidents of circumstances or, you know, deals in businesses and all that kind of stuff. If you look close enough, you can actually see why the world is how it is. And sometimes we won't understand it. And sometimes things happen which aren't recorded and we'll never be able to understand it. But we know that a lot is going on. However, to look at this book point by point, it's not a fairy story, because the entire point of Atlas Shrugged seems to be the philosophical underpinnings of the book and how to interact with your peers and how to interact with your the politicians and how to interact with your employees and your city and society, you know, and the economy and everything like that. But in this book, the entire kind of political system is like isn't developed in any way. It's like completely dismissed. There's no mention of it. It's just like, oh, people are doing this, oh, and then in Washington they've decided that, and then everyone has to live by it, and oh, and then Washington has decided this and they have to live by that. And I'm like, wait a second, well, who's backing this up? Who are the police who are backing this up? Who are the who are the army that are backing this up, and all these other things that I thought was part of part of the ob- ob- objectivist philosophy that Ayn Rand sort of espouses in this book, I thought that was all part of it. But it seems to just be like the whole political process is left out. And she's got these major misunderstandings of economics at like a fundamental level, which is troubling when this book is meant to be about living your life by a certain philosophy and how like politics and economics and business and, you know, and the way you run your life, it all comes out of that. So it's a bit weird how it's a preposterous, you know, self-contradicting book when it's meant to, like I say, meant to be a guide for a certain kind of philosophy. Anyway, the plot is pretty much the same kind of thing. The first part of the book is actually, I read the first, I read past it actually, but the first part is, you know, maybe the first 300 pages of the book or something. So it's like a novel length book in its own right. And it's actually not a bad, like a quite good novel of a railway operator or railway company under pressure from the political system who fights to open a new line when everywhere else the railways are collapsing, and this is sort of like this one company and this one, you know, manager in this company with the help of some other people, she manages to sort of like open this line. And it's, you know, it's quite a lot of it is just stuff happening instead of plot, but it serves a good purpose, you know, to, you know, the stuff happening, I mean, serves a good purpose to grind down the protagonist. And when they finally open their line, you feel a sense of achievement with them, and there's this love story going on that sort of plays out, and, you know, it comes to a sort of conclusion at the end of this story too. And Ayn Rand, so you get in plenty of preaching and plenty of philosophy and all that kind of stuff, but the preaching and philosophy does take a little bit of a backseat to the action and introducing the characters and getting to know them. But then once they get this railway up and running, it turns out that's just a minor part of the overall novel, which through my, you know, cursory reading throughout the rest of the novel, well, let me put it this way. At the beginning of the novel, the book opens with the line saying, "Who is John Galt?" And then we're told a little bit later that there was three geniuses at this school, like Harvard, but, you know, the alternative reality Harvard, I guess, kind of thing. And they were being tutored by these two professors, so three students. And one is Francisco, who's one of the main characters in the book. The other one is this dread pirate who is a pirate. And the other one, they say, and they ask, "Well, who turned out to be the other one?" It's like, "Oh, he's just some nobody, worked as a clerk or something in a factory." And I was like, "Oh, okay, well, that third person's obviously going to be very important." And then at the opening of part two of the book, our two protagonists find this, MacGuffin, it doesn't matter. They find something that was invented by this great genius, and they need to find him again. And they're looking around because they need to find him to fix it so they can use and sell this new invention. And at this point, I was like, "Oh, this is going to be John Galt, isn't it? Because he's going to be like the guy who disappeared. He's going to be one of these, you know, and who everyone's asking about it." So, and then also, as well as that, I found that there was this strange man who's been visiting these top industrialists and these money makers and these other inventors and stuff like that all the way around America. And after he visits them, they disappear. And sometimes they leave behind nothing. And in some cases, they leave behind everything. And in some cases, they disappear and they burn down their factories and oil fields and stuff like that. And at this point of the book, I lost patience because I was like, "Well, this is obviously going to be John Galt, but I don't really want to find out now. I mean, I don't want to read another 600 pages to be able to work out why, you know, John Galt disappeared and all this different kind of stuff." That's why I started skipping forward. And I picked up most of the plot. And Wikipedia confirmed this as well. So this is what happens. John Galt invents this new sort of free energy device, perpetual motion kind of machine. And he decides that he should be the only one to benefit from this. Or, you know, the people in Washington shouldn't be allowed to have any say in how he uses this new invention. And so before he tells anyone this new invention or publishes it or tries to sell it or anything like that, he disappears and destroys all evidence of his work and goes to live in the mountains somewhere. And then as the government becomes more and more collectivist and starts, you know, taking stuff away from these other industrialists and other inventors and these other different people who own these companies, he convinces all of these individuals to disappear along with him and wait out the coming apocalypse. So, without any help from these leading inventors and industrialists and everything like that, society collapses because nobody else is competent enough to run society or be able to make sure any progress happens or anything like that. Society collapses. And then at the end of the book, like a few hundred pages before the end of the book, they all come out of hiding again, take over, big speech, and then they create a new kind of free market-driven utopia on the ruins of the America that they have just intentionally ruined by withdrawing their own genius from the world. And these are meant to be the heroes, and we go, "Bravo! Yay! Hero! Go on strike! destroy America and then come out and everyone will go, oh man, John Galt is this great hero and he's the pinnacle of human endeavor and stuff like that. Now, I don't mind having a rich guy, inventor guy, be the hero. This is like really common in all kinds of science fiction. You know, you get the rich inventor or the guy who owns a company, he's a technical genius, and nobody else in the world has his vision, and he gets out there and does stuff. Like, read any Stephen Baxter book, and you'll find them working on projects like flying people to the moon or Venus or whatever it is. You know, that's the kind of thing that, you know, a lot of people like in science fiction. But these people, these characters are, at a very basic level, like wish fulfillment characters for all the nerds in, you know, who read science fiction and go, oh yes, these guys are the rational people, you know, they've got scientific know-how, they've got technical ability, and they're the guys who push through and become great men in the world of science and the great men in the world of everything like that. Now, of course, these great men exist in the real world too, but when they're in science fiction, they're there as sort of like fantasy projections of the nerds who both write and read it. But the thing is, are they really heroic if they're rich people who can just spend their money? Now, there are heroic people like this, no problem at all. There's one that stands out that came to mind as I was reading this book, A Hero Rich Guy. And it's the inventor in Misspent Youth by Peter F. Hamilton, which is probably one of his least appreciated books, mainly because it's actually a book about not very nice people doing not very nice things to each other. But at one point, before the book begins, he has invented this infinite storage kind of device where you can store all the media of the world in a little bit the size of your thumbnail or something like that. Yeah, a lot of information packed into a little space. And, you know, Hollywood collapses because then nobody wants to produce more new stuff because they can't, because, you know, everyone's just pirating everything everywhere like that and stuff like that. So it changes the world. The invention could have been worth trillions upon trillions of dollars or whatever it is, but he gives his invention away to the world. He just gives it away for free. And he's like, everyone says, yay, you're a hero. And actually, we find out later in the book, minor spoiler for this book here, you find out later in Misspent Youth that he only gave away all his invention because he was going through a divorce and he didn't want to make a lot of money for his ex-wife because she would then take half of his estate or half of all his earnings or whatever money. And he hated his ex-wife so much that he was willing to forego riches, and instead he released his invention to the world for free and he became this massive hero. And it was really an interesting, like, it's a really key insight into this character. He never intended to be a hero. He just wanted to screw over his wife. Not screw his wife, but screw over his wife as well, like that. Anyway, I can't remember why I wanted to tell that story. Oh, yeah, he was a hero, but he was a hero almost by accident. He was acting on unheroic impulses, but became a hero. Or the other way to, like, have interesting heroes, who are also rich and things like that, or already powerful at the beginning of the book, is that you have them with heroic intentions, but then they do the wrong thing in the name of heroism, and that makes for, you know, great tragedy. That's why, you know, the fall from grace of the kings and all these great figures in literature, that's what makes these people interesting. But what you have in this book is, like, you have, like, a hero who is great, he's a genius, and his heroic act is by, you know, running and hiding away from the world, convincing other people who could otherwise be heroic and great to do the same kind of thing, intentionally destroying an entire nation, probably killing thousands of people, whatever. He makes a big speech at the end of the book and is then held up as a heroic figure. Now, I skipped over big chunks of the book, and I might have missed nuance in the book which explained why this approach was actually a noble course of action, but the half of the book that I did read was entirely devoid, almost completely devoid of any nuance at all, like any at all ever. You know, this book is like the least shades of grey kind of book. It's all pure black and white, so I'm not really expecting a lot of nuance here as well. So maybe it explained why, if workers' rights and unions are so evil that, you know, at one point in the book, these railway workers wanted to go on strike, and this is held up literally as one of the most evil things that they could do, is that the union organisers, you know, who leech off these other people, you know, but then the industrials themselves go on strike. And maybe, I say maybe in the second half of this book, it's explained why this isn't completely hypocritical and ironic as well, that the industrialist and geniuses going on strike is a good thing and a good course of action. And they do it to uphold the country and to make the country great or something. Or they do it to uphold the law, and in the name of upholding the law, they just literally destroy the entire country. And then, so it's a bit strange. Like I say, it could be explained, but if it is, maybe I'm just crediting Ayn Rand with a bit too much nuance. And that's why I'm not, you know, this is not a normal review, because, you know, I'm just not going to wade through another 600 pages of a book that I'm not enjoying very much to see if there is this nuance, because I just can't see it at all. Anyway, the story idea is quite intriguing. Like, you know, I think, to be honest, like, what would happen if all of the geniuses and all the business leaders and all these different inventors just left society and everyone else just, you know, had to get on with it, like all the politicians and all the people who didn't normally produce stuff, or not, well, of course, it's the workers who produce stuff, but all the people who didn't come up with the new things for the workers to produce and do all that, and all the managers to run stuff, like, in their amazing, like, godlike ability of being, you know, amazing managers as well as inventors as well as all this other stuff, which the supermen in this book are, you know, and they don't do it. So it really reminded me of, you know, of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. That one part, I've mentioned it before on my podcast, where it talks about three spaceships that take off. All the workers are put on one, all of the thinkers were put on another one, and all of the people who did the service jobs, like telephone sanitization, all these other, like, not very important jobs, were on a third ship. And that third ship crashed, so the other two things were, oh, it doesn't matter, because we don't need all the people who do all the service jobs, we don't need all these leeches, we don't need all these moochers or whatever it is like that. We can just get on with it. We've got the workers, we've got the thinkers, we'll just get on with it and stuff like that. And Douglas Adams says, yeah, and the society worked well until they all died from ear infection from telephone sanitizers, which is actually, you know, came to mind now because I have a blocked up ear, like a completely blocked up ear with an ear infection myself. Anyway, so we got that kind of thing going on. And so in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, within like two paragraphs of backstory or an aside or whatever it was, I can't remember exactly how the story is told in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but it's just one of the entries into the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you know, meta book, if you would call it like that. So, but in like two paragraphs, Douglas Adams pretty much like discards the entire work of Ayn Rand. Well, not discards it, but sort of like just shows how stupid it is and how short-sighted it is just to go, oh, well, we'll just do this and society will collapse and it'll just play out the way we expect it to, you know, and all that kind of stuff. We'll just play this experiment and this is... But again, if it was just a science fiction novel, I wouldn't mind it so much, but this isn't just a science fiction novel. It's sort of set up as like this guide to objectivism, which is a philosophy which Ayn Rand actually thinks how people should live their lives or something like that. Anyway, I would like to actually write a book or read a book which is, you know, talking about how everyone who's intelligent and clever and stuff like that leaves society and the rest of the people get on with it, you know, just to see what happens. But I don't think I know enough about economics and politics to write that book. And unfortunately, I don't think Ayn Rand knows enough about economics and politics to write that book and make it believable either, which is a real pity. Anyway, moving on to the characters here as well. No characters take any kind of journeys, like Francisco, who's like this most interesting character in the book. He's this Argentinian copper magnate. Interesting character. However, he begins his life that way. He just amazingly knows everything about life and is just amazing from, you know, the age of 12 or whenever Dagny, our female lead, meets him for the first time. And he just grows up and he just does the same kind of thing and he doesn't change very much. Or he does change a bit, but it's a fake change. So even though he's to the outside world, he's acting like he's just a playboy and he's, you know, not bothering to work and stuff like that and do all these other kind of things. He's not really like that. It's just an act. So we know that his character is just an act, which is a bit of a weird thing to try and do in a book where characters aren't that complex. Like Dagny, the main female lead, she's strong and headstrong from the age of about, you know, three or something like that. And Hank Reardon, who's another main character in the book, he just appears fully formed. And the only thing that changes about him is like a realization that he hates his wife at some point or something like that. And it's weird. And then on the other side of the coin, we've got all the bad guys who are all like sniveling and whining and incompetent. And everything they say is like a fallacy or held in contempt and stuff like that. And on both sides, got this mindset expressed exactly in their physique. So like one to one. So like heroic figures in the book. The geniuses of the book are always, like, despite genetic heritage or lifestyle or anything like that, they're beautiful, they're fit, they're, you know, like, Aryan, they're white with, you know, blonde hair. Well, maybe not, I'm just, you know, pushing it a bit too far. But, you know, Dagny, the main character here, she's beautiful, and of course she's beautiful because she's like she's beautiful, isn't she? So of course she's going to be beautiful because she's a genius, and geniuses are beautiful. And I'm thinking, well, if she really is that much of a genius and really did put that much work in that we see her putting into this book, she'd probably fall apart, you know, her teeth would be dropping out from because of stress and stuff like that. And I was like, oh no, but she loves her work. but she like almost kills herself for it and stuff like that. And say, oh, and also she's just beautiful and has amazing sex every time she has sex. She doesn't have sex very often because most men aren't worthy of her. But when she does, it's just the best sex ever. And stuff like that. I was like, really? And then all the bad guys are like these sniveling guys and they're unhealthy and whining and things like that. And anyway, zero nuance, like I said before. None at all. Black or white. But, you know, I'm not talking racism or anything like that. It's like, geniuses. Yeah, geniuses are great. They have all the rights in the world. They're great. And everyone should look up to them. And they're amazing, stuff like that. And if you're not a genius and if you're not, like, if you don't own your own business or anything like that, that's great. Oh, that's another thing as well. Black and white here as well. How the companies are named, you can tell what the characters are like. So if you name your business after yourself, like, you know, or if your grandfather named it after him or something like that. So you've got Reardon Steel and I can't remember the names of these companies now as well, but you got Taggart Railways and Francisco's, you know, copper mines, stuff like that, and all these different people. If you name your company after yourself, you're good and genuine and, you know, a good guy and genius and things like that. But then if you've got a company which is called, like, I think there was like Amalgamated Steel and Metal Concerns Corporation, stuff like that, if you don't have your own name in the title, it means your company is bad and only gets by with political favors and stuff like that. And I'm just like, really? Is this the kind of level like that? Oh, but also, if you inherited your company and your grandfather named it after himself, you're a good guy. But if you didn't, I don't work it out. There's some rules here as well. And also, like, it's just really, like, pathetic. Now, again, if this was a fairy tale and the characters were meant to be just cardboard cutouts and all that kind of stuff, yeah, go with it, no problem. Just tell a story with, you know, caricatures and what do you call it, the archetypes and all that kind of stuff. But it's not that book. The book is trying to be a lot more than that. It's going for more realism. It's not going for satire and parody. And if it is, it's doing, like, a really bad job of it. You know, even like Brave New World is a satire, and 1984 in some ways is a satire. But this, you can't, even at that level, it's very difficult to read it that way, just because it's not written very well and the characters just aren't there at all. You know, it's really, really quite disappointing in that way. So at the beginning of the book, I said there's this first part of the book, there's actually heroic actions going on, because like Dagny and Reardon were fighting like nature, and they were fighting this system of inertia, and of course at some point they're fighting Francisco as well, because he's sort of at one point portrayed as this, you know, evil mastermind, or somewhere, you know, he plays an impressive business trick which almost ruins the companies and things like that. And what they're fighting against is actually, you know, when they triumph, you can feel proud of it, you know. But then soon, the characters aren't fighting against anymore. They're fighting against incompetence and political, you know, wheelings and dealings behind the scenes and stuff like that. And anyone who wasn't like one of these genius industrialists who slowly disappear over the course of the first part of this book, they are like by default an idiot. Like, Dagny, Reardon, they can do whatever they want just because they can, just because they achieve it. They want to achieve the impossible, and nobody else can, you know, do what they do, and they push through and they fight the odds and they win. But nobody else can even, like, just keep a business running, keep the status quo. Now, I know the entire economy is going down the pan, but it's like, you would think that people wouldn't be, like, willfully ignorant. I can't speak here. I can't even hear myself with my blocked up ear. So yeah, they can't do it. They're just incompetent. No matter how hard they try to run a factory, they just can't do it because they're not a genius and because they didn't build the company. They didn't start working in a mine and work their way up to working outside a mine and then bought their own mine and all that kind of stuff. So it's very strange. And that we do actually have one example of why a factory failed. And that was because it was an experiment in pure communism. Like, it really said, you know, that's what we're going to do. Everyone's going to earn the same amount of money. We're all going to help out. We're all going to vote on who needs what most and stuff like that. So those people were, like, you know, trying out pure communism and their factory failed. But all of the other failed industries in the book, which aren't run by these genius industrialists, just seem to fail, not for any reason. It's just like, oh no, we can't get the material. Oh no, we can't get the workers. Oh, this guy quit and stuff like that. And then I realized later on in the book that a lot of reasons why these different industries are failing is because the geniuses are withdrawing from the system. So what the geniuses who are left behind is the will, like the ignorance and incompetence of other people, of some people, like of the non-geniuses, and the willful ignorance and the willful destruction of the company by the other geniuses that are leaving. So we've got incompetence, ignorance, and willful abdication of responsibility, and that's what the people are fighting against. And I'm just like, this is really, really unsatisfying as, like, a course of a novel. Now, recently, a few days ago, a week ago or so, I watched the last of the Red Letter Media Star Wars prequel reviews. Go and watch them in order. They're very funny, and it's really cool. And they were talking about why Darth Vader's story in this... let me put it this way. If you like long, rambling reviews, which are as long as the books that I review, you'll like these, because I think, actually, in a way, the reviews last probably almost as long as the movies themselves do of the Star Wars prequels. Just go to redlettermedia.com or something like that. You'll be able to find them or search for them there. But, like, you can get as much enjoyment out of these great reviews of really shit movies, and you actually understand a lot more about filmmaking and storytelling and everything like that from these reviews, and you actually learn more than that and enjoy it more than watching the movies. And actually, I like to think that's what I can do here with my podcast. I like talking about great books, but also, you know, I think people get a lot from me talking about bad books, because, you know, I can... I like to think that's how I can bring value to bad books and bad entertainments and stuff like that. So they were saying that Darth Vader's story was the wrong focus of the story, or it should have been more of the main focus of the story. And they said Darth Vader, he wasn't, like, even the main villain in the Star Wars, you know, the original trilogy. He was just the one guy. But then again, you know, he was just, like, the right-hand man of the Emperor, and he was just one person among many of, like, the way that the Empire and the, you know, the galactic, you know, TIE Fighter, Death Star, Star Destroyer, that whole setup was already existing, and Darth Vader was just one guy among all of that. But then I was thinking, well, that's actually what makes Darth Vader a great villain. He gets shit done. You know, he fights with lightsabers. You know, he goes into battle. He flew the TIE Fighters in the first movie. He, like, in the second movie, like, in The Empire Strikes Back, he's striding around this bridge of the Star Destroyer. He's giving orders. He's the one who gets in Boba Fett, this, you know, badass, you know, bounty hunters that come in as well, and he punishes them. He doesn't disappoint them. You know, it's like when they go down onto the planet of Hoth, he's there walking through the, you know, he's walking through the, you know, the falling ice on the ceiling. And also, right in the very first time you see him, he's actually there, isn't he? He boards the Rebel spaceship right at the very beginning of Star Wars A New Hope. He walks through the smoke, steps over the dead and charred bodies of the Rebel fighters and the, and all, you know, the dead, what do you call them? Star troopers. No, what do you call them? Death troopers. Storm troopers. And things like that. And he's right there. He's in the face of the enemy. He's the one who's, like, literally going up and like, he's there and, you know, in the face of it. And he's there on behalf of the Empire. So he becomes the symbol of the entire Empire and what's bad about it. Now, I was just thinking, that's the reason why in Star Wars we can forgive that the Star Wars just can't aim for shit. You know, we forgive all the other contrivances of the plot and all the world building and all the stuff which just doesn't really make that much sense about Star Wars and things like that. We forget all of that because Darth Vader is such a badass, and that's why he is such a great villain, is that he is not just a figurehead, he gets shit done, and he's very competent. You know, when he wants something done, he pretty much gets it done, you know. And it's only by, and like I say, the rebels win because they really work hard at it, and there's a sense of achievement. And nobody is a genius if the person that they defeat are ignoramuses. Like, the people who come up with the plan to kill the, you know, the Death Star at the end of A New Hope, that's not our heroes of the story. Luke Skywalker, he can't come up with a plan like that. But, you know, the generals who are the geniuses come up with a plan like that because they're the only people who are good enough to fight against the geniuses on the other side. But yet, Luke Skywalker and Han Solo are... You know, they're the heroes of that story. And, you know, in some ways they face down, you know, like when Han Solo pulls the blaster and tries to shoot Darth Vader, that's like a yeah moment. Even though he fails, it's a heroic thing to do. And then he gets tortured and captured and all that kind of stuff. Spoilers. But that's what we like about it. You know, even you don't need to be a genius to... let me put it this way. They win even though, like, the heroes are heroic even though they're not genius. Whereas in this book, the heroes are geniuses and they're fighting against ignoramuses. It's like the movie Idiocracy, if you've seen that. It works only because the person who goes into the future, into the world of morons and people who have sort of bred intelligence out of the human race. They're all idiots and stuff like that. So they can't send a genius into the future. It wouldn't be funny. It wouldn't even be a clever story. So right at the very beginning of the movie, they say, we need someone for this experiment, for this hibernation experiment, and we're going to pick the most average person. He's going to be average build, average height, and most crucially, he's going to be average intelligence. They say that very clearly at the beginning of the movie, because if they'd have sent a genius into the future, geniuses versus idiots, not very fun. Someone who's like remarkably average versus lots and lots of idiots, actually quite satisfying. But here in this book, we have geniuses versus idiots. But then you realize actually they're not geniuses, they're only viewed as geniuses because the idiots are so idiotic, you know. And that's what I dislike. When I was over in New York, Rim from the Geek Nights podcast, he gave me a series, like this anime series on DVD. He says, oh, this is the best anime series, you'll really like this. And I watched the first episode, it was pretty good. The second episode, there was these dogs, and at one point, to move the plot forward, he was walking with dogs, and this dog was like really, really really valuable, this dog. And suddenly the dog just pulls on the leash, and this guy lets it go. He lets the leash go. And I'm like saying, this is meant to be our hero, and he's that stupid that he's got this really valuable dog, and as the dog pulls on the leash, he manages to let the dog go. It's like, no, he wouldn't do that. First of all, he wouldn't walk around with the dog on a leash. He'd have it chained up somewhere if it was that valuable. And if he did have it on a leash, he'd have the leash wrapped around his hand like everybody has leashes wrapped around their hand if they don't want the dog to suddenly, in a burst of movements, run away. I was like saying, so I couldn't really invest in the genius or the whatever this... you know, this character was meant to be and meant to represent. And I thought, as soon as that happened, I thought, I'm not going to like this series, because the only way that they're moving the plot on is to have, you know, idiotic things, or not idiotic, but like stupid things happen that characters do. And yeah, very, very unsatisfying there as well. Anyway, moving on. Some relationships in this book. It seems to be like whoever espouses the philosophy the best, or who is the pinnacle of the philosophy, they're the most attractive, despite all other human characteristics, which is great, you know, if you really want life to be that simple. However, life isn't that simple, and so human aspects of relationships are also important. Also, the greatest form of sex in the world, higher than any level, is only slightly indistinguishable from rape, which I'm not going to get into, but it makes me just think, really? Anyway, moving on. Science and technology. You've got this different... There is science... let me say, it's not just because it's like alternative universe or secondary world that this could be called science fiction or fantasy. There are actually some science fiction elements in it. There's Riordan metal, which is some kind of alloy, which, strangely enough, someone invents, but nobody else can work out how he does it. Now, I don't know that much about, you know, chemistry or physics or working with metals and stuff like that, but I think the way that you actually discover things about metal is by studying metal. And this guy comes up with this new invention, and nobody else can work out how it's done, and he's the only guy who can do it. Now, I think that if you've got a sample of metal, just by using, you know, high school knowledge of physics, you could probably work out quite a lot about, you know, an alloy, because that's all it is. He didn't discover a new element or anything like that, a new stable element, and manage to mine it. No, because he's getting ore from places and is mixing it or treating it in some way. But it's really strange how nobody can work that out. And then, like I say, this atmospheric energy motor, which draws energy. Oh, this is the MacGuffin, by the way, this perpetual motion machine. I'm just like, yeah, whatever. Now, again, I don't mind, like, stupid inventions, things like that. I just go with it. No problem at all. If you want a stupid magical invention, go with it. However, if to be great with a philosophy, you've actually got to be so great that the only thing you can do to be as great as you have to be a true practitioner of you know, the philosophy that Ayn Rand is espousing here, is to actually invent things which go against the fundamental tenets of, you know, physics and chemistry and stuff like that. It's like, oh, check it out, he invented this new thing. Well, how did he do that? Oh, he reformulated our understanding of energy from scratch, so the second law of thermodynamics no longer holds true. It's like, oh, that's really great. Is that the level that you really have to achieve? Is that what Ayn Rand has to say, that you have to, that's the pinnacle of objectivism? you know, that you can actually have to, you know, literally break the world, the rules of the universe to be able to get there. Anyway, so it's a bit strange. I'm not going to talk too much about this. I don't want to talk too much about the writing style. It's, like I say, descriptions are great. Everything else about it is bad. Dialogue, terrible. Preaching, all that kind of stuff. And yeah, very unsatisfying. But like I say, I didn't finish the book. Apparently at the end of the book, I did find it as well. A 70-page speech. Someone gets on the radio, actually on television, but it's a television with no picture. And then he starts, this is John Galt when he's taking over the world. He gives a speech and it just goes on and on and on. And so people who were mentioning on Goodreads.com, following my review along on Goodreads.com, mentioned that as well. They said, oh, I was listening to an audiobook and the speech was taking too long. So I fast forwarded an hour and the speech was still going. And I'm and this is meant to be the speech which changed the world and everyone held John Galt up to be a hero. Oh boy. So, different themes. Oh no, a little bit more about this. Actually, I made a note here as well. I was listening to the Writing Excuses podcast, which is actually really good. Even if you're not interested in writing, if you just listen to these guys talk about it, because they talk about reading and books that they like and stuff just as much as they do about their own books that they write as well. And they did this podcast a few episodes ago called Insulting Your Audience. And they were saying, what's the most insulting thing that you read in books? And what's the most insulting thing you can do when you're writing books? And two of the main points that came out is, one, preaching. And I was like, wow, I'm reading Atlas Shrugged at the moment. And I'm like, preachy, 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 preachy. And the other one, of course, is that they said was straw men arguments. Or, let me put it this way, having your point of view succeed just because the other people, just because it should succeed, you know, it's just fairy tale telling like that. And you don't defend your own philosophy or you don't defend your theme or your message in any way at all. And the other way that you can do it is by doing strawman arguments, like you set up your side and then misrepresent the other side. And the only way that objectivism looks in any way appealing in this book is because what they're fighting against is like the worst kind of like Soviet, well, not Soviet, but, you know, like communist kind of, what am I trying to say? You know, like the collectivist idea of just like stealing from people and giving it to everyone else, like stuff like that. Now, again, say what you want about the political systems, but I know that's not how the world works. Generally, the world works as a whole big mix of different kinds of political philosophies and different kinds of constitutions and all these different things. You know, a lot of the world is like a mixed economy. It's not either or between, you know, communism and collectivism and, you know, completely free market capitalism. But the only way that the free market capitalism can even be slightly shown as something great and the way to go is by this completely utter black and white thing and the opponent to be, like, say, ignorance and all this other stuff. Because I know it's bad to say this, but or a way to say this. Well, it's not bad to say this, but let me just explain this. I was talking to someone the other day and they were saying, oh yeah, China, human rights abuses. And I'm like, yeah, but you get the same thing in America. So you see these two superpowers now, or, you know, one emerging superpower, one sort of fading superpower. And you say that, well, the way that China is becoming a superpower is the wrong way to do it. And the way that America became a superpower is the right way to do it. And why is that? Well, because of the human rights abuses in China. Now, in a way, I totally agree. No argument there at all. Except you see the result of the human of the American system taken to its logical conclusion is wars around the world of aggression, wars, you know, preemptive strikes on like non-aggressive countries, you know, wars for oil and all that kind of stuff. And you can't just say, oh, well, that's just this government. No, it's not. It's a result of, it's a long-term result of the capitalist free market system, with massive amounts of, you know, business interests and Washington run by special interests and by the powerful and stuff like that, disregarding the poor, running down the poor, massive inequality in the United States as well, like that. And you just got to think of it, how many people have died around the world because of American aggression. Now, I'm not saying that I have better answer to this, but I'm saying that the Chinese system, which started off with, you know, enforced government and human rights abuses, is slowly evolving into a much more open society, much more free society. You'd probably say within, what, 10 or 15 years, there might even be free elections there. But again, they're doing it, they'll aim for those free elections once they've got the majority of the population out of poverty. Whereas America is driving people into poverty. The stated goals of China is to bring people out of poverty. Now, I don't want to make a value judgment, a dismissive value judgment, to say one is better than the other, but it's got to the point now that I can't just go, oh, well, communism like Chinese communism bad because of human rights abuses and all the things that go with it, and American free market system good because it helps everything out, because I just think the world is a little bit more complicated than that. I went to this show in London the other day, and there was a scientist, Ben Goldacre. No, he's a doctor, isn't he? Ben Goldacre. And he was saying... He's going to make these T-shirts. At least I think it was Ben Goldacre. He's going to make these T-shirts which have this saying on it. It says, I like to think that the situation is a little bit more complicated than that. And what you do is you stand with that T-shirt next to people who have got slogans on the T-shirts or signs which are like, up with this, down with this, and this kind of thing. And you stand next to them and see if you can take a photograph or get someone to take a photograph of you standing next to someone. And your more nuanced view comes through with a statement. I think you'll find it's a little bit more complicated than that. And that's what I get from this book as well. Like, all these different things set up. And that's why I wanted to just mention that little, my thoughts about China and America. Again, value judgments is one thing, but it is complicated, and you can't just say one thing is bad just because, and you can't say another thing is bad or better just because, when actually if you look at the net amount of suffering in their countries, America's system is actually creating more inequality, is creating more suffering in its own country, you know, with a healthcare system and stuff like that, you know. And China, while it started from a bad place, is actually aiming higher than that. So maybe the aims are more important, but the means, but then the means and the aims. So it's all this weird stuff there anyway. So that's it. Let me see if in the last 10 minutes of this podcast I can go through all my objections to objectivism. I'm not going to go into what it actually espouses and stuff like that. Don't read this book. Read up about it on Wikipedia. Like I say, it can only exist in a strawman-filled fantasy world, and the actual basis of the philosophy, I think, is quite intellectually unsatisfying, because I can't take seriously a philosophy which seems to, at its very like base level, is self-defeating or self-denying or self-contradictory. I think I've mentioned this before in my podcast, that you can, like, a very rough guide to some big moral questions you can sort of look at to see if the very concept of not going with the moral choice leads to a contradiction, or leads to the lack of meaning, or leads to nothing in a way. Like, so for the easy examples is lies. Okay, so telling the truth is good, because if everybody lies all the time, the actual concept of truth or the concept of lying no longer has any meaning, and stealing as well. Okay, if everyone steals, the actual concept of stealing disappears, because then there's no such thing as property. Now, animals can get on with that, you know, humans can lie, but, you know, maybe animals can't steal because they don't have, you know, a way of property and stuff like that. So I'm not saying it's moral, I'm just saying that to work in the system, you can't just go, oh, lying's okay, and killing as well. If everyone just killed indiscriminately, it leads to nothing, it leads to one person just there. Like I'm saying, if you take it to its, like, absurd extreme. And this is what I find, quite simply, you know, again, maybe I need to do more reading about it, but at the very root of the objectivist philosophy is the idea of the emphasis of individuality. Now, what I find interesting is in this book that all of the guys who and women as well in this book who are like espouse the objectivist point of view and want to live their life that way, they all these geniuses all fulfill exactly the same root, and they all pledge to each other to hold nothing above each other, or nothing above, except their own individuality and self-worth, and, you know, their own selfish, self-serving morality or whatever it is, like that. And so, in the end, all the good guys in this book, and I can't see any way else apart from it except, you know, in any way to have a more nuanced view of objectivism, is that you have exactly the same mindset as Ayn Rand and everything like that. So in the end, taken to its conclusion, you have this hegemony of a thought where the natural outcome... Oh, no, wait, put it this way. I can't express myself here. I'm getting confused with my words here. So the natural outcome of the individual... the individuality defeats the notion of individuality, when the only way to live your life in a purely individualistic way creates no individuality, which is a contradiction. You know, if everyone is an individual and everyone lives their life by such individual means that everyone is actually living by exactly the same means in exactly the same way, nobody's an individual anymore. So, again, like I say, I'm not a philosophical genius, but I can sort of see, like, this is like just a conclusion from the like the base axioms of her things as well. And also she goes, you know, free market capitalism with no government is the only moral conclusion to my philosophy. And again, I'm no genius about philosophy, but I just go, wait a second, I can use exactly the same basis and get fascism, you know, which, you know, we know from history doesn't have a great track record, you know, in the world. We pretty much everyone agrees that fascism, it probably isn't the best way to go about things. But no, that's not she was against that. But, you know, free market, you know, capitalism, everything like that, no government controls or anything like that. That's the outgrowth of this moral philosophy. But then we look in the book, and actually the outgrowth of the moral philosophy is almost indistinguishable from fascism itself. You know, it's literally the praise of the Superman. Everyone else, you know, it's just, I don't need to go into this, you know, because, like, if you've got any interest in philosophy, you probably have looked into this anyway. And if you don't, well, don't bother reading Objectivism. There's plenty of other philosophy out there, which is way more interesting. What other notes have I made here? Oh yeah, capitalism awesome, socialism awesome. Oh yeah, as well as mentioning the China America thing as well, I actually quite like the idea of free markets, of different degrees of mixed economies of socialism and capitalism, because I think socialism is awesome. Like I say, capitalism, both great, both have got like massive amounts going for them, and I do think that together they are like the least worst form of government we've ever come up with. But what you get in Europe is you get like this free market of different degrees between the capitalism and socialism and other kind of political systems. Now I guess they're all sort of aiming like in the same direction, but I actually personally I prefer the system of government in Germany more than I do in the UK. And if I like the UK better, I'd probably move back there, or, you know, it'd be a reason to move back there. And if I really didn't like a government, I could always move out, in the same way that in this book the guys are like, oh, we don't want to live under the system, we're gonna go away. And of course, if I wanted to, I could go live in the USA, where they have a completely different political system, or I could probably swing it to live in the USA. And then again, I've always got the chance to go to Somalia, where there is no government and there is no law, and it's all every man for himself, and people are pirates, and people are just, you know, doing whatever they want to, and it is purely like dog eat dog, one man for himself, and all this kind of stuff. And what was I going to say about that? Yeah, I like the free market of different kinds of government, and go where you want to. Except in this book, they don't even think that. They're just like, oh, well, let's just destroy an entire nation. Let's just put the whole world through a massive disruption and then see if we can get it like that. And what else did I want to say here? I think I've got one or two more notes. Oh, yeah. See if I can quickly do this. I was just reading this blog post. Read my recent blog post that I made about the art of self-help and business advice as well, because I think that it talks a little bit about what I wanted to do. Again, it's one of these things that I sort of read that kind of thing, and because I was reading Atlas Shrugged, I'm like, okay, I've got more to say about this. Anyway, I just want to talk a little bit about, again, bringing back my personal side of this. I've got quite a few emails recently saying, hey, we actually really like it when you talk about your personal side and bring in your own personal stories and stuff like that. So I was on the beach the other day in Barbados, and I was there with the other people working on cruise ships, and one lady, Tina, she often works on the cruise ship, but at the moment her husband is on board working, so she's just on board, we call a wife on board, or a girlfriend on board, she's a wife at the moment. And we were chatting about it, saying, wow, this is a great life, isn't it? Yeah, it's like, we're getting paid. She wasn't getting paid, but I was like, yeah, I'm getting paid to be here, sitting on a beach, getting an ear infection by swimming in the sea in Barbados, although I didn't know that at the time. But a great time anyway. And then so other people coming over and we're chatting, and someone said, oh, yeah, guest entertainers are paid way more than anyone else on the ship for doing way less work. And that's actually true. You know, my position on the ship, I do, you know, a few nights work every week or something like that, and I do get paid a lot more than most people. The other side of that is that they work on a ship constantly. So say if I get paid maybe, say, 3 or 4 times as much for them, but I can only work 1 month per week or something like that. So it just works out, you know, by time and stuff like that. And I said, yeah, I put, you know, 10, 15 years of hard work into my job to get me where I am today. And somebody else said, you know, who's got a desk job, they said, well, I put 10 years of hard work into my job as well. I went to business school and did all this kind of stuff, and now you're getting paid more than me for, you know, chucking things around on stage as well. And I just had to say, yeah, of course, but, you know, there's less people doing my job, and I'm just luckier that I had an interest early enough that I could do this kind of thing. You know, I knew at the age of 13 that I wanted to be on stage performing for a living. That's why, you know, I did that kind of stuff. You know, it was just a passion that I had. And also, it worked out for me, so I was just lucky. And I've talked about my, you know, personal philosophy now, before. If you go back and listen to number episode 100, I say that, you know, I work hard at everything I do, but I know that hard work or genius or knowledge or inventions or any of these things, they only give you like the edge to the very best of people, if you know what I mean. It puts you slightly ahead of others, because the most important thing that determines the success in most people's lives is luck. It's just circumstance. You know, the vast majority of people, you know, achieve success because they stayed at what they were doing long enough that chance sort of fell in their favor, and then they take that path, and that's what they do. It happened to me. And knowing this, that's what I say, this is why how I you know, apply it to my own life, is that in every area I try to make myself receptive to luck as I possibly can. And I always want to make sure that if a lucky situation does come up, I can fulfill that role as well like that. But, you know, taken to the next level, I know that the only reason why I live my life like I do, and I have this view of luck coming into play so much more and making me be successful, is because of circumstances outside of my control, luck anyway, which is luck, you know, it's just chance and stuff like that. And then if we want to apply it to an even a different level as well, the genius inventors and the great leaders of our time, you know, it holds true for them as well. They have their genius minds and stuff like that, but they don't have like an innate, like, it's not like an innate right of the individual. It's not something they worked for, even if they have worked a lot for it. It's the circumstances of their birth, of their genes, of their just their situation in life as well. You know, Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, you know, very rich technology pioneers and geniuses. No, I'm not knocking them for not being genius or something like that. But it just so happened that they were in the right age when it was like nerdy computer kids and stuff like that were just in the right position, that they had the right skills and the right different things like that, and the vision as well. But it just so happened that they had that skill and that vision at the time when technology was opening up to a wider audience. And they had, you know, they were young, they weren't already, you know, working for businesses, you know, and they could set up their own businesses and do what they wanted to do because they had time, they had the opportunity, and they had the skills at the right time. A year or two either way, they would either be working for a different company in a job because they'd have to make ends meet, or they'd be too young to set up the businesses, or they just wouldn't have the skills yet and things like that. I just watched the movie, The Social Network, and Mark Zuckerberg, obviously a genius, you know, no doubt about it. There's no way he could get to where he's got without having some kind of genius. And he worked very hard, of course, as well, you know, and he happened to have the right skills at the right age. But, you know, if he'd been a year older, he probably wouldn't have had time at university to do what he did. And if he'd have been the year younger, he wouldn't have, you know, been at university, and the guys, the Winklevoss twins or whatever it was, wouldn't have come up to him and said, hey, look, there's this idea, can you help? Or wherever he got that idea from, you know, he paid them off. So it's probably, you know, it's probably some truth to the movie. I'm not saying that's exactly what it is. But, you know, a year either way, and he wouldn't have been at Harvard, or he'd have been doing other stuff, and he wouldn't now be doing what he is. So here's a thought experiment. Imagine everyone in the world flipping coins, and if you flip a tail, you sit down, okay? So the chances are that everyone in the world pretty much flips a tail right away and just sits down. And as you continue, everyone flipping coins, more people sit down. And you don't always have to flip coins at the right rate. Some people can go faster and some people can go slower. And you can stop whenever you want as well. Most people flip coins until they're pretty successful and then stop flipping coins, and that's it. But some people will just randomly manage to flip coins like maybe 10 heads in a row and just keep standing there. You get someone like Warren Buffett, who's an investor. He's flipped lots of, you know, he flipped enough heads in a row. So now, you know, figuratively speaking, he's no longer flipping coins. You know, he's, you know, building on his wealth and stuff like that. But many people were flipping coins at exactly the same rate as him for exactly as long as him, but then just flipped a tail instead. You know, the last head that Warren Buffett flipped, they just flipped a tail instead. And now we don't hold them up to be the richest men in the world. They're just sort of like average businessmen or something like that. We don't hear about them and stuff like that. So should we look at the people on the top of these fields, like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, and should we like think that they made their money on their own? Because personally, I find that hard to stomach that they did. And because I don't consider my success my own. I tried very hard and I worked very hard at my own success. But, you know, other jugglers, other people like me, they did the same kind of thing, but, you know, circumstances didn't come together and they flipped a tail a few times, and then they thought, well, okay, the juggling thing's going to not work out. And so I don't see myself as anything greater than other people in a way, and I don't see what I have in terms of money and opportunities and skill and things like that as anything as my right or anything like that. It's just part of me, you know, it's just part of the world, and I happen to be this in this position. So that means I do a lot to help other people also, you know, be lucky. Well, not be lucky, but, you know, like, my money, I can't really use my money in a significant way because I don't have a significant amount of money. You know, I actually live, I have plenty of money to spend on my own, but it's only because of, you know, my lifestyle is that I don't actually have a lot to spend on when I'm traveling and things like that. And Berlin is a cheap place to live and stuff like that. So me, I've got plenty of money, but, you know, giving it to other people isn't where I'm going to make the most impact. However, I'm very rich in talent and passion about the different things that I do. So I want to help other people with passion and talent, and by teaching them, especially in the realm of juggling. I'm not going to get into it, but, you know, I do quite a lot of work. I'm doing workshops all the time. I give people a lot of advice. Anyone can email me anytime and I get back to them. You know, I try to just entertain people, which I think is very important, just to inspire people in that way. And when I go to juggling conventions, I'm working almost constantly to help people out, to give other people opportunities to perform and do their best that they can on stage and stuff like that, and to, you know, become a success in their own lives. But so that's when people say, like, oh, it's your money, you worked for it, you can do what I want. And I just have to say, look, yeah, but I think you'll find the situation is a bit more complicated than that. And I think that is what brings me to my final point about this book, is that this book is almost evil in the way that it considers everything black and white. You know, it goes all the way through the book, the people just sneer at the people who want any charity or have any kind of sense of altruism or have any kind of, you know, I really haven't got into, like, say, so much about the objectivist philosophy, but it's completely denying any kind of charity. And if there is charity, it's only self-interest, you know, charity for self-interest and all these different kinds of things. And it's, but also that anyone who thinks that that is wrong, that people should give charity, I don't think people should always give charity, but, you know, I don't think anyone should be forced to give charity. But this is the point, is that it, no, like, for some point, it goes everyone according to his ability, to everyone according to his needs. And one of the characters hears this and they fume inside themselves and they say that's the most evil thing. And somebody else says, oh, look, you know, just to help other people out, you know, in this straw man disagreement, in a way that I have to disagree with because it's a straw man, they say, oh, okay, this railway, we're going to close it, or you're not allowed to open that railway because it's, you know, it's unfair to the competition and we got to close it down. And the character's like, well, if you're going to do that, we might as well just all kill each other if you're just going to be like that. And of course, in the end, that character does just end up killing other people because then she doesn't go, because these other people don't go by her point of view and other people's. Anyway, so it's just like holding up the opposition as evil all the time, and this completely, like, black and white, you know, polarization of philosophical, moral, ethical, political, economic issues is really, really, I think, damaging and just a bad way to look at the world as well, like that. And so I think, you know, everyone according to his ability, to everyone according to his needs, I think that's wrong as well. For me, it should be like everyone according to his ability, as much as practical, and as much as practical, like everyone according to their needs, but, you know, don't take the piss. Nobody really needs a fortune of more than, say, $1 billion. If you've already got $1 billion, you know, you probably shouldn't be fighting against sort of like massive, you know, like, at least, you know, some kind of sliding scale of taxes to help out other people, because, you know, you're only lucky to be. Again, it's sort of like you can't just do a pithy quote and say, oh, everyone should be like this. So, no, I think you find the situation is a little bit more complicated that way. And again, I got into this discussion online and someone says, oh, I think the political system should be like this, some kind of, you know, Plato's Republic, that we should have a, you know, do this and everyone should be working for the common goal of humanity and everyone should be working for the, you know, the betterment of society. And I just said, well, yeah, if everyone's like that, what would you do with the people who don't want to work for the betterment of society? And they're like, well, they shouldn't be in society. I was like, well, what are you going to do? Kill them? You know, discard them? Tell them that they can't live there? What are you going to do with them? And he's like, well, you've got, well, they should work for the betterment of society. And I was like, well, maybe I just don't want to. Maybe I'm, you know, going through a rough patch, you know, just broke up with a girlfriend again, you know, and maybe I don't feel like doing anything. Maybe I don't feel like contributing to society. Maybe I just feel like going sitting down over here for a while. What can I do that? It's like, you see, you've got it all. For any kind of political system or any kind of economic system or any kind of philosophical kind of system, your philosophy or economics or political system has to be able to include people who just don't want to get on with it, who just disagree. And also it has to include the people who are just too apathetic to even enter into the discussion. And it's got to include all these other different things, because life really is that complicated. And I think it's really damaging that obviously so many people, when they're like 15 years old or 20 years old or something, will read a book like Atlas Shrugged. And that's what happens to it. You know, the Atlas Shrugged, or what is it, the Atlas Society gives out, what, like 500,000 copies of this book every year to school children to sort of like get them to think about objectivism in the way that, and I think it's just, you know, it's just one of those things that I think is just probably damaging. And, you know, I don't want to, like, condemn the book or anything like that. I'm not going to bother reading it. I'm not going to recommend it to anyone. It's too long. I'm not even going to give it a rating because I didn't even finish it myself. But, you know, I thought it would be important for me to talk about it in some way like that. It's just like, stop the hating. What's all with the black and white stuff? Even most philosophers, they in their own, you know, systems, they have to, you know, have ways of doubt being in there. And doubt is just a massive thing about the world. Doubt should be like the basis of most, you know, most philosophical inquirers, whether objectivism, there's just no doubt about it. And anyone who disagrees and wrong isn't being an individual or isn't being an individual enough. And then in the end of it, if you're not being an individual enough, you're not, you know, conforming to the very narrow mindset of objectivism. So anyway, that's the end of my review. Hopefully you've enjoyed this. I know it's been rambling, but you know, sometimes it's fun just to sit and talk for an entire hour about a book which you didn't finish. But like I say, I think I've probably read about two novels worth in this book. Anyway, no rating for this one. Like I say, next podcast that I'm going to do, it's a book I've already finished. It's Starship Troopers by Robert A. Heinlein. It's a short book, and I'm going to say at the beginning of that review that you should listen to this review first. But also I'm going to talk about that as a really good representation of philosophical, or if not philosophical, but political thought in the form of a novel. It's like Atlas Shrugged done right, even though I suspect that Robert A. Heinlein probably didn't agree with what he was writing about. Or maybe he did. But again, he wrote lots of books with opposite and contradicting life philosophies and politics. So I'm never quite sure exactly what his position is on any issue that he writes about, which is a good thing. You know, it's at least it's honest. Not a lot of straw men. Some, but not a lot in his work. Anyway, that's the next book that I'm going to review. I'm not sure when I'm going to actually have internet access. It might be like another 5 days before I have internet access again, which means that it's been 5 days since I recorded this podcast. Maybe my ear will still be infected. I'm going to go and see the doctor on the ship now anyway. So thanks a lot for listening. If you've got any comments about anything like that, you can comment on my review of this on goodreads.com. There'll be a link on sfbrp.com and on the blog post about this episode. Or you can email me, luke@juggler.net. Follow me on Twitter. I put different updates there as well. I'm @LukeBurge there. You can follow my blog where I do lots of other writing and different stuff. I put lots of stuff up there about the end of my year, 2010 in review, like 8 different blog posts about the stuff that I got up to in 2010. And I'm soon going to post my plans and goals for 2011, if anyone cares, probably not. But lots of stuff going up there all the time. That's lukeburge.com/blog. You can also read my own philosophical musings in the forms of novels if you want. You can find them on my website too. Otherwise, thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.